go. There it is. Okay. Okay, I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker, Rocky from San Clemente. Hey, bye, Rocky.
My name's Rocky, and I'm an alcoholic. You'll have to check with my agent on the recording part. But, now, my sobriety date is November 3rd, 1995. And my home group is the Monday No Old Ideas Men's Stag Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor is Sandy B., and I say those things because I think they're important. They've been an important part of my sobriety. This meeting's been an important part of my sobriety. I've taken a birthday cake every year here, and at the beginning of my sobriety, there was a man here that had the same, had a similar profession who I had, and helped. He helped me a lot in this meeting, and some of you remember Mike H. And he's no longer with us. Mike and Rebecca, Mike. And he had about 5 or 6 years when I came in, and I thought that was just amazing that anybody could stay sober for 5 or 6 years. And when I had about 5 or 6 years, he decided he would go back out and try it again, and today he's not with us. So I'll get to some of that a little bit later in my story. And I want to welcome the newcomers. All those that identified and those that didn't. This is, you know, this is the program. You know, I spent thousands and thousands of dollars on therapy and trying to figure out what was making me tick and go the wrong way. And, you know, for a dollar in the basket, I guess it's $2 now, inflation, but for a dollar in the basket, this program has taught me more and done more for all the things that have been good, that are good and joyous in my life than I can even imagine. So if you're new, just try to stick around until the miracle happens. You know, get a sponsor. Try to stick it out. I know it's hard at first. It was hard for me at first, and I'll tell you a little bit about, you know, one of the times coming to my very first time coming to this meeting, and a little later in my story. But what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. I'd like to say that, you know, I was the reason that I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I'm probably dual or tri-addicted. There's no doubt about that, that I'm really good at addiction. But I like to say it's because I grew up in a terrible area, or I had a bad family, that my parents beat me, or they were alcoholic. But the truth of the matter is, I grew up in South San Clemente in a middle-class family with a loving mother and father who weren't perfect, but they weren't alcoholic. And San Clemente, you know, in the 50s and 60s was a really neat place to grow up. You know, I mean, I went to grade school at that school right there. And kids, you know, I work with a lot of kids. I'm really fortunate to work with a lot of kids today. And I'll say, well, what school did you go to? Well, I went to Concordia. Or I went to Lobos. And I go, well, I went there too. And they go, wow. You know? And so it was a really idyllic place to grow up. I don't know, you know, we talk about alcoholism skipping a generation. And it very well could have skipped a generation in my family. My dad, he shows all the signs of being a dry drunk. And, you know, for all you men, and I think this applies to women too, does anybody relate to having father issues? You know, I bet you there's not a guy in this program that doesn't have father issues. Well, I had father issues. And, you know, but it really, you know, I don't blame all that on anything. And I just think that I have a wire crossed, and, you know, that I need this type of program to keep me focused. You know, I ran into a fourth grade teacher of mine the other day. I hadn't seen him in over 30, you know, maybe 40 years. I mean, a long, long time. And he said, wow, I remember you. And he said, you're a good kid, but you couldn't sit still. You know, and that was me. I mean, I was busy. You know, my brain was busy. It was always going on inside my brain. It was never quiet. It was never peaceful. You know, and I knew everybody didn't feel like that because they looked more comfortable than I felt. And I couldn't figure that out as a young man or a young kid. And then, you know, I never felt like I was enough in the eyes of my father, and I never felt like I was enough in the eyes of my friends, and I never felt like I had enough inside me. And I knew that early on. And I knew that wasn't normal. I didn't think that was normal, but I didn't know what to do about it. And so, you know, when I was very young, I remember, you know, parents would have guests over and there'd be beers, and I would, you know, I remember, you know, maybe I was 10 years old or something like that, and getting a hold of my first beer and drinking that beer, and I just loved how it tasted and went down and made me felt. And I knew right then that there was something about that. You know, I didn't know exactly what it was, but anytime I could steal a beer or something from my parents' cabinet, if they allowed us to have a sip of wine or champagne at a dinner or a Thanksgiving, I was first in line. And I don't know why that was, but you know, I showed early signs of really wanting to gravitate towards something that made me feel different. And you know, my dad, he was a pharmacist, so he was a professional guy and he was a perfectionist. And you know, he warned me about all the, this is the late 60s, you know what I mean? Everybody talks about the 60s being, you know, wild and woolly. Well, it really wasn't. The 60s just kind of got things started. It was the 70s and 80s that really got bad. But, you know, in the 60s, you know, I can remember my dad saying, you know, there's this stuff called marijuana and there's these things called drugs and this is going on right here in Laguna Beach, and don't you go down to Sleepy Hollow area in Laguna Beach. And guess where I was when I was 12 or 13? I had to go down and see what was going on there. I mean, I just, you know, whatever he said not to do, I did. And so that was the relationship we had. And I was kind of lucky. I was a really good athlete and nationally ranked in a couple sports. And, you know, I could never get the respect of my dad. If I won the gold medal or I won the tournament or whatever it was, he would have always said, well, yeah, but if you worked out more, you did this more, you'd even be better. And there's a guy in Idaho, there's a guy in Iowa that swims faster, or there's a kid in Florida that shot a lower score, or whatever it was. It was always hanging that carrot out in front too far for me. And so, you know, eventually, you know, I got a little bit older, and you know, I went to high school here in San Clemente, and by the time I was a sophomore, I had about 30 schools offering me letters of intention for scholarships in two different sports. And, you know, and I was working hard at that, trying to get the respect of my father, and, you know, and that was never going to happen. I mean, he loved me, but he didn't know how to hug me and say, you know what, that was great. You are great. I'm proud of you. He never knew how to say that. And, you know, they were stoic from the East Coast, and that's just how they did things back then. And so, you know, as I became a father, I decided that I wasn't going to do any of that. I was going to be exactly the opposite. I was going to hug my kids, and I was going to tell them how good and how great they were. And you know what? It didn't work. They still show signs of being alcoholic or are alcoholic right now as young adults. So, you know, how does that work? Really gooped up kids come from really great families, and sometimes really great families come from really great kids come from really gooped up families, and vice versa. I don't think there's any rhyme or reason to it. But by the time I was in high school, I had discovered drinking alcoholically from the very first time I got enough to drink. I drank to a blackout. I passed out. I threw up, and I couldn't wait to do it again next weekend. And that was how it was for me. And, you know, my sports didn't seem so important. What was going to happen on Friday and Saturday night seemed more important. And what, you know, anything to make me feel different seemed more important than succeeding at the things that I was good at. I was a pretty good little student, and my grades went to crap, and my sports went to crap, and my family was fighting over me, and, you know, there was stress in the household and all the things that go along with that. And I didn't care. You know, I just wanted to get loaded. I just wanted to get high. I just wanted to, you know, and about that time, you know, I discovered drugs that would let me drink longer. And I discovered some things that didn't make me throw up that I liked better than alcohol at sometimes. But, you know, there was always both things around. And so I'm a sophomore in high school. I'm kind of going the wrong way. I discovered that, you know, if I sold drugs, that I'd have plenty of money to have drugs, you know. And I was very entrepreneurial from a young age. Very, very entrepreneurial. I was a sophomore in high school, and I got busted. I was a junior in high school, and I got busted with about a pound of pot in my locker and a bottle of vodka. And that was a big deal in San Clemente. That was a lot back in the 60s. It was front page news. And the police came to my house and arrested me and took me away in handcuffs in South San Clemente. And I got thrown out of school and thrown out of sports and put on probation. So, and that didn't stop me from doing any of the things that I did. You know, I had a probation officer I had to report to. Five or six, seven, 8 months went by. You know, I'm not in sports anymore, so now I'm hanging out. I have a job, but I'm hanging out surfing, and I'm hanging out with the surfers, and the older guys from Laguna were coming down, and they thought I was cool because I was entrepreneurial, and they were entrepreneurial, and you kind of put the dots together there, and, you know, so all that was going on, and I can remember, you know, saying to my parents, you know, I just got to get out of this town. You know, I just can't live here in San Clemente. I can't live with you. I'm almost 17 years old, and I want to leave home. And my mom and my dad are fighting all the time. And my dad says, you know, it'd be better if you did. And I said, well, how can I do that without being a runaway? He says, I don't know. Figure it out. And, you know, I was still on probation. And I had a couple older friends, you know, that had moved off to Hawaii, to the North Shore of Hawaii, to surf the big waves and do the things that we were going to do over there. And you know, I got one of them to sign on as a guardian for me. He was 21. And that was legal. And I remember going to they used to have surf movies up in Laguna Beach High School. And I remember borrowing my dad's car and picking up a whole bunch of kids from the south end of San Clemente. And I remember we're driving to the surf movie in Laguna Beach, and we've got, you know, like six or seven of us in there, and we've got pipes going around, and the thing's just billowing smoke, and we're drinking. And I pull up to the stoplight there at Crown Valley Parkway, and I look over, and right there is my probation officer with his window down, sitting with his wife in the car. And he looks at me, and he goes. And so now that's Friday night. Monday morning, I get the call. Come and see me. And I figure I'm going back to juvenile hall. You know, I mean, this is for sure I'm going back to juvenile hall. And I'd already been there once. And he brings me in. He says, you know, you're a good kid, but, you know, you're just not doing well here. He says, isn't there someplace else you can go? Some other family that lives somewhere else that you can go stay with, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I don't know why he didn't slap the cuffs on me. I don't know why that is. And I said, of course, bing. I said, yeah, I've got it all set up. I'm going to go. And I have a guardian in this town in Hawaii. And I said, I've got this correspondence school, and I promise I'm going to finish my high school, and blah, 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 blah. And the guy goes, pulls out a paper, signs it off, and hands it to me and says, "You're off probation. Do what you want." And I don't know why that was. That would not happen today. You know, anyway, so I did my first geographic. I'm 17 years old. I've got a guardian, a place to live. I've got a 10-speed bicycle, a couple surfboards. The bicycle's stuffed full of hash and pills that I'm going to sell when I get there. And I got $600 in cash, which was quite a bit of money back then. And I move off to the North Shore. And the North Shore is wild and woolly, and there's a lot of big boys over there and a lot of big Hawaiians, and I get to know them all, and I'm cool because I've got the bag of whatever. And, you know, people wouldn't know I'm 17, you know, I'm acting like I'm a lot older. They don't have any idea I'm a juvenile, or they've probably been scared to death just to, you know, contribute to the delinquency of a minor and all that stuff. But anyway, I move off to Hawaii, and I spend several years in Hawaii with my disease progressing fairly rapidly. And again, got to surf all the big waves, got to do some really cool things in the ocean, which I really love. That's really, you know, a big part of my life. And I've been all over the world, but I keep coming back here because we have this beautiful place we live with, this beautiful ocean. And you know, but I'm sitting in my room, I'm sitting in my house, my beachfront house on the North Shore, and I'm not coming out of the house for weeks at a time. And I'm buddy-buddy with the Peruvian surf team. And, you know, and we're entrepreneurial. You know, and we figured out how to hollow those surfboards out and go to Peru and come back and make a lot of money. And we figured that out, and, you know, that we were off and running. We were 18 years old. We had millions of dollars. We were out of control. We had cars, boats, planes, homes, you name it, we had it. All the stuff that you could ever think of, you know, in your wildest dreams, we had it, except that we didn't have the blessing of the local organization over there. And they kind of came along and they told us, "Look, we know what you guys are up to, but either you're going to cut us in on the thing or you better get the hell out of here." We were gone the next day because we didn't want to have anything to do with us. So we moved back here. Moved back here to Corona del Mar. Got a nice place down there in, on the bluff. You know, and we were off and running. We had, you know, we were really clever. And we were really locked into our disease, and we were, you know, and we were crazy. And I mean, we didn't sleep for days on end, and we crashed cars, and we should have been dead, and we OD'd, and got revived. And I mean, all the things, and our diseases progressed, and it was always, well, if I can do this with Grand Marnier, or maybe I can do this with this wine, or maybe I can do this with this. And I was always trying to get the mix right, and I was always overshooting. But again, we had, you know, money to get us out of trouble. We had money to get us in trouble. And we got in trouble. Eventually, I got in trouble a couple different times, but thank God I didn't get in trouble internationally like some of my other friends did. Some of my friends died in jails in Asia. They died in jails in South America. It didn't matter where it was. If we could fit it into something and sail it around the world, we figured out how to do it. You know, we were very clever. And we worked really hard at it. And, you know, what amazes me is now I know through the steps of this program and learning about how I felt about myself, I'm fast-forwarding, but I know that if I had to put any energy into anything, I would have been successful. If I had put that much energy into anything else legal, I would have been totally successful. Eventually, I got caught. It was the, at the time, it was the largest cocaine bust that had ever happened in Southern California. It was in all the papers, Channel 7 News. I got sent away to prison. I did some time in state and federal prison, quite a bit, actually. And, you know, that gave me time to think. Took a while, you know. It took a while. I didn't get sober in prison. Actually, I stayed stoned pretty much the whole time in prison. But when I got out, I was afraid to do anything illegal because I didn't want to go back to prison. So that left me cocktails. And that's what I did for the next 10 years. I drank. And, you know, I was a daily drinker, and I was trying to grow up. I knew there was something wrong with me. But during that time, I revamped one of my sports and became a professional in that sport and got a great job, fantastic job. In fact, I still have that job today, 30 years later, okay? And I'm blessed. Most people would just die for the job that I have. But 10 years of drinking, I got married. I had two kids, two beautiful kids. Bought a house down on Trafalgar Street in San Clemente. Had all the stuff that, you know, that a guy had. Not doing anything illegal. Just every night having my drinks. And couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. I wasn't doing any drugs. I'd kicked all these habits. I was strong enough to do that. You know, I had figured out that the adrenaline rush of running the border could be replaced by, you know, doing things on the ocean and doing some extreme sports. I figured out a lot of neat things about myself, but I never figured out I was an alcoholic. I did not have a clue that alcohol could do what it did to me. But it brought me to a place where it was so dark and so lonely and so scary. It was scarier than that prison. It was scarier than those courtroom dates. It was scarier than running the border. It was scarier because I wanted to put a gun in my mouth and I couldn't figure out why. And I just didn't know what was wrong with me. And, you know, so my wife decided that she was going to go back and do some dope. And I decided, you know, I'm going to divorce you. Because I don't do that. I just drink. And so we divorced, and I ended up with custody of the kids. So I've got these two kids, a neat job, a neat place to live, and I feel like killing myself. And I don't know why. And I decide I better go to a doctor and find out what the heck is wrong with me. So I decide I'm going to go to Scripps Institute, which is the best hospital around, I think. And I'm going to take the executive physical, okay? Because, you know, I'm an executive, right? I mean, that's, you know, I'm grandiose, right? So I go down there, and it's a two-day physical. I go down there on a Thursday, and you spend the night there, and they fast you, and they poke you, and they probe you, and they run you, and they give you a ton of things to fill out. And there's questions and questions, and I'm paying $3,000 for this physical. So I'm answering the questions honestly, and 2 days go by, and then at the end of the 2 days, they serve you this really nice lunch in this private executive room, and the doctor comes in and talks to you. Executive physical. So this doctor sits down. I didn't need an executive physical. I needed to stop drinking, but I didn't know it. So the doctor sits down with me, and he says, I know what's wrong with you. And I'm sitting there, okay, what do I have? Cancer? Am I bipolar? You know, what's going on? I mean, you know, I'm a fairly educated guy. What's going on with me? He says, nope, I'm throwing out these guesses. And he says, have you ever thought you might be an alcoholic? And I said, well, you know, come on, doc, I was strung out on this, I was strung out on that, I did this. I mean, we were crazy. I'm toned it down a lot since then. And he says, wait a minute. He says, what do you feel like inside? He says, I feel awful. He says, you're an alcoholic. He says, I'll show you. And he pulled out a piece of paper and he said, you see this number? It's supposed to be this. And he says, yours is 10,000 times higher than it should be. And I said, 10,000 times higher than it should be? He said, yeah, 10,000 times higher than it should be. He says, you're 41 years old. He says, you will not live till 51 at this rate. He says, I can promise you that. Oh, man. So the good news is, he says, have you ever tried to get sober? And I says, no. I said, hey, I don't drink in the morning. I go to work. I have a job. I have a house. I have. He says, stop. He says, that's not what this is about. How do you feel inside? He says, you need a program. You need to get into rehab. And I said, you know what? I don't think I do. And I said, I'll see you later. And I got up and I walked out. Now, all these years, working in where I work, there was a neat old guy that worked where I worked. And a few of you will probably remember him. His name is Harry Gibson. Harry the horse. Harry died about 10 years ago with 35 years of sobriety. And I used to always go into Harry and, you know Harry. And I said, I used to always go back into Harry's. My office was on one side, his was down the other. And I used to always go down there and I said, you know, Harry, you think I got a drinking problem? You know, this is going on and that's going on. And, you know, I'm not feeling too good. But, and he'd always look at me and go, no, you know, I think you're okay. I don't think you're, you know, like I was. And he would always tell me that. And I don't know how he knew. But that night after the physical, I went home and had one more good ripper. Got a big bottle of vodka. And so now it's the morning and I'm having to open this golf course. And I'm opening the golf course and I'm feeling terrible. And Harry's down at the other end calling the people to the tee and stuff. And 12 o'clock rolls around and I'm off my shift. And I walk down into his little office and he looks up. He's figuring out the books and he just looks up and he goes, oh, you're ready. And he just knew I was ready. I didn't have to say a word to him. And he says, he said, let's go get a cup of coffee. And so I told him about the doctor. The doctor was funny, though. He said, have you ever heard of the 20 questions for Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, no. And he says, well, there's 20 questions. They say if you answer three yes, that there's a real good chance you're an alcoholic. He says, well, you know all those questions you answered? He says, we tricked you and spaced all those in there, too. He says, you answered 18 of the 20. He says, now you need to quit drinking. So anyway, the doctor scared me. I went down to Harry. Harry says, look, we need to start going to meetings. We need to start doing this. We need to start doing that. And we did. And we started going to meetings. And, the first meeting I went was the men's meeting at the Monday night men's meeting, which became my home group. And I walked into that meeting, and there was a whole bunch of guys there that I used to drink with. And I hadn't seen in a while. And the next meeting I went to was this one here and on a Friday night. And then Mike Haltom, who's a golf pro too, says, oh my God, you're here. First, we've been waiting for you, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And great, we're going to do this and this and this. And we started hanging out together. And then, you know, I was really lucky. There was a couple other guys that decided to get sober a month or two later. Really good friends of mine. We're all about the same age. We're all just scooped up. So we're all pretty bright guys. And everything's falling apart. And all of us got together and we would go from meeting to meeting. Every night was a different meeting. And some of the meetings we went to because there was coupons at. And some of the meetings we went to because there was men who were sponsors that said, you got to go to this meeting or I'm going to kick your ass. And we went, it was the next couple years were actually the most exciting time of my life. And I mean, if you look at my life, people would say, wow, you've done some really wild things. You know, you've been to this country and that country and had this and that and blah, 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 blah. The most exciting time of my life was getting sober. I'm going to tell you, because I got to know me and I learned to like me. And I learned to feel enough. And I learned what was wrong with me. And I learned that there was a cure. And it wasn't that complicated. You know, I love the part where Clancy talks in his talk about, you know, going to the hospital and going to the first floor in the cancer ward and telling people that, you know, and everybody, that they would sign their houses, their cars, their estates to be cured of that cancer, and then going to the next floor and talking to the alcoholics who are also dying, and him and he's saying, all you have to do is show up at meetings and do these 12 steps and put a buck in the basket. And they're telling him, no, I'm okay. You know, that's how cunning and baffling and powerful our disease is. You know, so anyway, those next couple of years were really great. There was four or five of us that we'd meet at my house every morning for a cup of coffee. We'd decide where we were going to go that night, where we were going to eat, where we were going to go to the meeting, and where we were going to go after the meeting. And it was like that. And my kids, I would drag my kids in here and put them back there with coloring books. And I was raising these two kids and staying sober and, you know, and doing the deal. And I remember I was about, was sometime between November and December. So my first month of sobriety, and this is a funny story because this was my spiritual experience. And I've told this in several meetings before, so a couple of you may have heard it, but Harry told me that there was a really good speaker coming to Aragon, and that I had better get there early, and because it was going to be full, so it'll be packed. And so, my in-laws, the grandmother of my kids, they lived up in Corona del Mar, and they thought that they had decided that they wanted to have the kids for the weekend to decorate the tree and do all that kind of stuff. It was sometime in the early December. And I'm thinking, okay, great. If I can drop them off at 6, and then they're going to have we're going to have dinner there, and I can get here to the meeting by 8:00. And of course, they're alcoholic too, just like my ex-wife. That now she's my ex-wife, but they're functioning alcoholics, and they aren't going to drive with the kids anymore or anything. So I go up there. And you know how nothing ever gets served on time if you're in an alcoholic household. So I'm trying to get out of this place, and it's like 7 rolls around, and 7:30 rolls around, and Christ, all she's making is hot dogs and macaroni and cheese, and she can't get it on the table in time because she's having her wine, right? And finally, it's like 7:30, and the meeting here starts at 8, and I'm in Corona del Mar, and I says, you know, I don't want to walk in that meeting late and have everybody look at me, you know, because like everybody cares, you know, but of course I did, you know, at that time. I hadn't quite figured it out yet. But anyway, so about 7:30, I said, you know what, I got to go. And I jump in my truck and I pull out there by Newport Coast or by Corona del Mar, and my gas tank is empty, and I pull over to get like $5 worth of gas, and I start hauling ass down the coast highway in this truck. This big old truck, big truck. And all of a sudden, I'm about halfway through Laguna Beach, and I realize I haven't hit a green light. I haven't hit a red light yet. Every light's been green. And I've got this thing pegged about 45 going down the coast highway. And, I mean, if it was red, I would just... And all of a sudden, I just felt the presence of God next to me. And every single light, I hit 27 green lights in a row. And I pulled up here, and somebody was pulling out of a parking space right there, and I pulled in, and somebody was ringing that bell, and I walked in here. And, you know, from that day forward, the obsession to drink left me. I didn't want to drink anymore after that day. And that was, you know, so this meeting's meant a lot to me, you know, in my sobriety. And you know, the friends that I've made in this program it just amazes me, you know, the group of friends that I have, you know, today. I mean, and the coincidences that happen in AA. I mean, today, I told my girlfriend Mel, I said, you know, I'm speaking on Friday, because I actually wanted to speak at this meeting for a long time, and no one ever asked me. So I finally asked Marcia, I said, hey, I'd like to speak at the meeting. She says, I need a speaker next week. Coincidence, right? So I told Mel and a couple of my friends, I says, Mel, make sure you call the other Marcia and a couple other people. And so I'm pulling out of my house today to go pick up Mel, and I'm thinking, well, did she call Marcia? And I look over, and I'm at the stoplight, and there's Marcia in her car, right here. And she rolls down the window and says, what are you doing, dude? And I says, I'm the speaker tonight. She says, I'll be there. You know, but that's how, you know, there's so many street signs that your higher, if you listen to your higher power, you know, there's so many street signs, so many turn signs if you listen. And, you know, Harry, my first sponsor, you know, he told me, he said, because I was a little baffled with God. You know, I remember going to Sunday school and getting a perfect attendance record to win a prize, and the guy, the Sunday school teacher, which was probably just a dad, forgot about the prize. And after that, I was done with church. I was probably 11 years old. You know, and he probably just forgot. But I was supposed to get to go out and get a hamburger and a milkshake with this guy. And I, you know, so I mean, God was something that hadn't really, and you know, Harry taught me, he said, well, here's how, and Harry was never the guy to drum things at me. He was the perfect sponsor for me because he would make suggestions. Because he knew I was pretty bullheaded. I was pretty type A. And he would say things to me like, you know, I just talk to God, just like he's one of my friends. He said, try it. You know, and that's how the God I understand is. I can just talk to him and say, hey, God, what should I do here? What's going on? Give me a sign. And you know what? If my eyes are open, there's always a sign there. You know, those are the things that I've learned in this program. You know, the men's groups have helped me probably more than any one thing. And today I have a sponsor, and I also have another person I kind of call a sponsor too, because one's really spiritual and one's really logical. And one will tell me what I need to hear on the spiritual side and make me ponder things that I might not think, and the other one will call me on my bullshit, which gets pretty out of hand at times. And so, you know, I've learned to use those tools. And the tools that we have in this program are absolutely amazing set of tools. I really believe that a 12-step program should be taught in every, maybe middle school. You know, when the kids, before the kids get too far into the boy-girl thing, I really think that would be a really great, I think it would make this a better world. It's my opinion. It lasts everything on this podium is my opinion. And, you know, I hope I didn't offend anybody by the talk about my drug use, but, you know, that's a part. You know, there's probably not many AAs left that don't have some kind of drugs in their story. And I know it's a little bit against the traditions, and there's certain meetings I probably would cover it up and say outside issues or with this or that. But you know what? That's just sugarcoating. It is what it is. I had to go through what I had to go through to get to this point. And the thing that got me to this point, the thing that I'm most proud of, is the fact that I've been able to stay sober continuously for this amount of time. And all the other things in my life that I'm proud of, which, you know, are my kids, my job, I got to start a great business, I get to work with some fantastic young people. I mean, parents bring me their kids to work with because their kids won't listen to their parents. Duh, no kidding, your kids don't listen to you, they need to listen to someone else. You know, but it takes a village, and I'm sometimes that guy, and I'm honored to be that guy. But none of it would have happened without the things that I got to learn in this program. And you know, I'm continually learning, you know, the steps. I've gotten to do the steps formally now 4 times, where I actually go through and do the work. And each time, I kind of go in there kicking and screaming and in some kind of pain and emotional turmoil. And every time I come out a stronger person and a better person. And, you know, I got to do them with my first sponsor. I got to spend a week with Dr. Paul doing them, who's like if you don't know who he is, you newcomers, he was like an AA guru. He has a story in the blue book, in the big book. You know, I got to do them with the guy that calls bullshit on me. And I've got to do steps with lots of guys that I sponsor, too, and I get a ton of satisfaction and learn so much about myself by helping those guys with their programs. You know, this year has been a very interesting year for me. We lost Mike Holtom, who was you know, here at this meeting. It was the secretary of this meeting when I came in who helped me. I lost two more friends that both had over 20 years in the program this year because they decided that, you know, maybe they needed a few pain pills or maybe they could have a glass of wine and drink like a gentleman. And they're not with us today. These are guys, you know, in their mid-50s that had a lot of time and families and successful careers and kids, lots of kids left without fathers, you know. And they were here for a long time. And that scares me a lot. And so, like, I've been stepping up my program and going to 3, 4, sometimes 5 meetings a week and making those phone calls and doing the things after this amount of time. I'm doing more now than I have in many years because I'm still getting more out of it. You know, I'm still learning. There's more will be revealed. Harry used to tell me that. More will be revealed. You know, because I wanted to know everything. More will be, and it is. It just keeps, the pages of the book just keep turning and turning and turning. Probably the biggest thing that I had, I got to learn about my fears. And, you know, the biggest fear that I had when I told that doctor down in Scripps that, you know, maybe I'll think about it, you know, and I said, I'll see you later. Well, the biggest thing I feared right then was, how am I going to have any fun? Because I like to have fun. I mean, that's the truth. We're not a glum lot. It says that in the book. We like to have fun. Most of us are way above average in intelligence, and we like to have fun, and we like to cut it up a little bit, and a little bit too much too sometimes, right? Yeah. I was afraid I wasn't going to be able to have fun, and you know, today looking back at that, man, I have so much fun. I get to do so many cool things with so many cool people in so many cool places. You know, it's just amazing. I don't have time to do all the things that I want to do. And, you know, I make pretty good use of my time, I feel. And I still can't squeeze everything in. So, you know, if you're new and you're going through that kind of a fear, that's a real fear. And I get that fear. I really get that fear. But stick it out a little bit. And you'll be amazed at the fact that you can do things and go places and meet friends. And I mean, probably the scariest thing for me was, how am I going to have a relationship with a woman and be sober? That was really scary. That petrified me. You know, and now I look at that and I go, wow, I get to remember what happened. You know, I get to feel the joy and the pain and the this and the that. And you know, and it's okay that it's not all here. It can be here. It can be here. And, you know, just doing nothing or just being a little gray can be okay. It can be an action. Doing nothing can be an action. I learned that in this program. You know, one of my biggest faults, you know, my character defects is I want to do something and fix it right now. Sometimes you can't fix it right now. You just have to wait. And that's hard for me. To this day, I'm still trying to not fix it. You know, I'm trying, but, you know, it's against my personality. I want to fix it. I want to make it better. I want to make it work. And you know, sometimes you can't. You just have to wait. And in God's time, it'll work when it's supposed to work. I guess, you know, the tools, the friends, the self-respect, the life I have here, you know, I'm so grateful for. And, you know, I got to find out through this program, you know, what was wrong with me, and I got to find out how to fix it. And, you know, to me, there's no greater gift that and then knowing that I have a God that I can talk to on a daily basis. You know, those are things that I cherish and that are precious to me. And you know, I guess that I finally, after a long, long period of time, I got to feel inside like I was enough and that I'm comfortable. You know, most of the time I'm pretty comfortable And to me, that, you know, was something I never had before, and I do now. And you know, if you're new, stick around. If you're old, turn up the volume on your program. If it's, you know, feeling a little weak or you're feeling a little anxious, you know, everything we have, everything we need is right here in that book. And you know, we're so lucky in this area of the United States to have so many great meetings and so many great people. I have an office that I work out of in Asia, in the largest city in the world, 32 million people, and there's not one AA meeting. Not one. There's one guy listed as a rover. I have his cell phone in my cell phone. I've talked to him a few times. We haven't met yet. 32 million people, not one AA meeting. It's in China. But, you know, there are some meetings in some of the top-tier cities in China, but not in this one. Pretty amazing what we have here, you know. Take advantage of it. It's been, you know, it's by far the best bang for a buck that there is. Thanks for letting me share.